I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. John Manuel Arias' sophomore novel, Crocodilopolis, is a multi-generational family saga set against the political backdrops of both Costa Rica and Washington, D.C., with a focus on two brothers, Seth and Isario, a modern-day Cain and Abel, who grow up together amid familial strife in the 1980s. Early on in the book, we learn that Seth is planning to murder Isario in a unique way. He intends to lure him to a river full of crocodiles in Costa Rica. I recently spoke with John Manuel Arias about the book and about the competitive nature of brothers. Here's our conversation. There are so many subjects we can broach when talking about this book, and I'm going to try to hit them all, but maybe you can start by giving us a brief description of the book. Could you set it up for us?
So Crocodilopolis starts with Seth Oreamundo. He is an ex-politician, a defanged version of his powerful self back in Costa Rica. He's exiled in Washington, D.C. and has been for the last 10 years. And his younger brother is to blame. They were born into a corrupt political dynasty. And when they grew up, they became politicians. And of course, the younger betrayed the older, got him exiled. And as we're with Seth, he is so frustrated with his life, he decides, you know what, I'm going to sneak back into Costa Rica and feed my younger brother to a river of crocodiles.
You know, so much of the book revolves around these two brothers, Seth and Isario. And about halfway through the book, there's a list of competitive brothers. And among them was Cain and Abel, brothers which our brothers are explicitly compared to, aren't they?
Yeah, this is a very fascinating idea, right? The novel has a lot to do with fate and cyclical ideas when it comes to nations, right? We have another rising wave of fascism throughout the world, and that happened about 100 years ago. And if you look back through history, you always have brothers fighting brothers. And what are they fighting over? They're fighting over power.
I'm going to break in right here to say that I spoke with John when he was in Costa Rica, and initially the audio kept dropping out. We switched to a different device, and it was much improved. You might not be able to tell the difference, but if I had the before and after back to back, you absolutely would. Okay, so here's John explaining the list of competitive brothers.
There's a very specifically Costa Rican thing to do because there are so many plants here that when you're with someone, you are always identifying the plants. You're saying, this leaf looks like that, this flower looks like that. And as the brothers are on their way to the river, they're turning this into a competition, as brothers do, identifying these plants. And the plants in their own game start to identify the brothers. They say, you all look like Cain and Abel. You all look like Eteocles and Polynices. You remind us of these things. And it's really fascinating to think back to these cyclical events, right? Brothers are often historically and mythologically destined for rivalry. And I wanted to explore that. I really wanted to get deep into it and say, how do brothers actually get to this point? We hear the myth. We learn it in history, but what can bring two brothers to this destined point?
You know, you mentioned Cain and Abel, and they are clearly from Genesis in the Bible. And there were so many mentions of things being biblical throughout, and also mentions of the devil, like all over the documents were the fingerprints of the devil, or someone had done the devil's bidding, or the devil is in the details and all that. So what did you want to explore here when, you know, when some of the characters in the book would point at something and say, it's biblical?
Costa Rica is a very Catholic country. It has historically been, and it is still very Catholic. And I find the iconography, you know, I'm not a Catholic myself, but I find the iconography and the mythology very fascinating. How it interweaves into everyday life and how these forces, whether they be spiritually present, they're culturally present. So this idea of Job, I believe it was Job, where God and the devil are saying, I can take this away from him and he will still worship me, right? It is destined for either humans to fail or to succeed in either good or evil. And who is sort of orchestrating this? So this idea that humans can assign their destiny to someone else, or they can take it into their own hands. And I think the Bible is very exemplary of that, especially the book of Job. There are a lot of references specifically to the Leviathan. Lots of the chapter heads are named for passages within Job about the Leviathan. Some 19th century scholars actually believe the Leviathan was not a whale nor a sea serpent, but a crocodile. And I really wanted to get down into the muck and explore that.
You know, you talk about people being destined to do something, and I found it interesting that destiny seems to play a large role in these lives, especially if you consider the, you know, the argument of destiny versus free will. Because my impressions of some of the main characters shifted as I read. There were times when I both liked and greatly disliked Seth, Asario, their grandfather, their mother, their father. There was a point when Seth said this of his grandfather: "I could never shake the inkling that he'd transitioned into my life from a previous one, that he'd been someone else before I met him." Were their lives shaped by destiny?
I feel like the excuse of a life is shaped by destiny. Sometimes one can assign their actions and their sins and crimes or whatever you want to believe to something that they're predestined to be. But then there is something really fascinating about that that I explored in my first book, Where There Was Fire. I had a patriarch of a family who was a banana laborer. Who is informed that his daughters might not be his. And I'm thinking about a Costa Rican patriarchal society, about somebody of a lower class, and this sort of act of violence he commits. And I'm saying, well, what other choice would he have had within the parameters of his own life? How many options were available to him? And in all lives, whether we are brought up to search for power, like these political brothers, or to nurture a new generation of power, what parameters does society set for us? And what parameters do we set for ourselves and call that destiny, right? How is it easier to call those systems of power and those borders that define us as destiny, as either an excuse or a logic to the things that we do throughout our lives.
You're listening to Marginalia. We're visiting with John Manuel Arias about his novel, Crocodilopolis. Now, there are some interstitials throughout the book. Each begins with Costa Rica is a home too, and we get descriptions of crocodiles, the beauties and the mysteries of Costa Rica, and even the dangers of men and tourists. And the text is formatted uniquely with irregular margins and lines. It's poetry. I think I saw somewhere that it's, is it erasure poetry?
Yes.
Can you talk about crafting these sections and your intentions here?
The book starts off with a very literary, but also very scientific, and also very gruesome description of what an American crocodile is. American crocodiles can grow to be 20 feet. They live throughout the Western Hemisphere, very concentrated in Costa Rica, very concentrated in a very specific polluted river here. They can grow to be 20 feet, they can grow to be 2 tons, and they're kind of these perfect killing machines. And in this idea of their majesty, I saw a parallel between them and this idea of power. And so throughout, I wanted to explore with this section something that's called blackout poetry. So if I get rid of some of the lines, what is actually brought forward? And I wanted to explore it as well as a type of hieroglyph. So here we're beginning with the original message, as the ancient Egyptians might have left hieroglyphs. But what happens when these pieces are torn away? What meanings do we glean from this? And how do we apply it to our understanding of history? And I really wanted to do that with each section, explore with this poetry, how can thematically I can apply this or really explore these characters.
I have interviewed a few poets who have also written novels, and as can be expected, I'm never disappointed in the prose. Crocodilopolis is your second novel. You mentioned you had also written Where There Was Fire. For you, how does writing a novel compare to writing poetry?
It's very different in the length. I think in the most utilitarian and practical sense, I have limited space in a poem, which actually means that there is greater meaning with every single word, right? I have to make every word count, every line count. In a novel, I can expand that to 100,000 words. And that's a really fascinating place to be. And to, you know, I take a lot of pride in the way that I handle prose, right? I really see the beauty in sentences in books that I read and books that I try to write. And so to be able to sustain that standard of myself for 100,000 words is in itself a challenge and actually something very fun, because if there's something I want the reader to walk away from or from my book, is that, wow, that was a great sentence. That was a really fun sentence. I'm going to underline that, or I'm going to savor it, right? Like a dish.
Well, I will forever be stealing your spatchcocked paperback description. I loved that one.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
There were some references to light and dark. One of the boys thought that God is light. But then later in the book, there was this quote, "Light creates shadows, which means love creates hatred." You know, with a poet's eye for layered meaning and ambiguity, even this seemingly universal definition of light and darkness juxtaposed, you know, against good and evil and love and hatred is in question, isn't it?
It's fascinating because it's two parts of the same whole, right? And I wanted to, you know, we've been talking a lot about religion and the Bible, and I kind of wanted to challenge the idea that the opposite of God or the opposite of good is the devil and evil, when in fact all of it is sort of this whole, right? Their father becomes a pastor, evangelical preacher eventually, and he, instead of the New Testament type of God that he emulates the Old Testament God, the plague bringer, the flood provider. And, you know, this idea of this ancient duality that not only sort of this mythological being or beings can hold, but also one can hold within themselves. And what I really wanted to do actually throughout the book is position not hatred as the opposite of love, but power as the opposite of love, right? There are many people who want power because they see things as a finite resource, money, celebrity, but there are those who see love as a finite resource. And what do they do in order to gain it?
I mentioned there were some heavy subjects that you worked into this book. And, you know, it does span so many decades. Toward the end, though, it's 2018. We are in Costa Rica, and there is a clash between a pride parade and a group of protesters, a grassroots group that was, and this is a quote from the book, easily gathered into one web of nationalism, xenophobia, and homophobia, a holy trinity as good as the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And, you know, as I was reading this, these scenes felt like they could have just been happening in the United States, yet these were set in Costa Rica. Can you talk to me about what you were exploring here? And is this something that is kind of universal around the world, these clashes between these groups?
The simplest answer is yes, absolutely. You know, we're in 2026 right now, and Costa Rica has just elected a fascist president who announced in her acceptance speech of the presidency that she was looking to get rid of individual rights. She announced a new republic. So the book goes back to 2018, which is the very recent ascension of the Trump presidency. And in the same way that the Make America Great Again movement exploited and awakened really intense feelings of homophobia, xenophobia, transphobia, it happened throughout the entire Western Hemisphere as well, in a way that Franco or Hitler or Mussolini awakened this beast of fascism and control and eventually violence, right? We see in the CIA Operation Condor, and we can see the way that the United States, or in that era, Europe, use these awakenings of control and conservatism also as a means of colonialism. Right. How do we see right now Marco Rubio calling all these very far-right leaders for a meeting in the United States? And how does that look like Operation Condor, that happened with the CIA in the 70s and the 80s here in Latin America?
So this novel jumps around a lot in terms of location and timelines. I'm wondering, is the order in which we read the book the order in which you wrote it? And how do you keep track of the details of time and place and such?
It was definitely written the way the reader is reading exactly the way that I wrote it. The history of the brothers and their family is interspersed by Seth going through his days, the mundanity of what it feels like to be planning to kill your brother. He goes to the bank and gets out tens of thousands of dollars that he hoarded years before. He fixes the sink of its strip. He teaches his son math, multiplication problems. And I wanted to juxtapose that with this kind of really deep, rich, and brutal history that is happening in the past and that is complementing the way that Seth is moving throughout his days as he's planning his murder plot. Right. And I see time as something that doesn't necessarily exist. I don't see it as a straight line chronologically. However, I do see it, especially in literature, something that is thematic. If I am doing something right now, I can be thinking about something that I did 20 years ago, or I can be projecting something 20 years from now. Time is happening all at the same time through our memories and through our hopes and dreams and what we are literally doing right now. And I really like to explore that, not as much in Crocodilopolis as I did in Where There Was Fire, where time was completely amorphous in a way that a poem can be. This one is much more structured, it's much more straightforward, but I really did want to intersperse and explore that idea of time. End of cycle, end of destiny, right? Always we go back to the beginning and we hop back into the future.
This did not play a large role in the book, but I did note it when I read the sentence, and I wanted to ask a little bit about it, and maybe just because I'm hungry. But you wrote that culture is passed down through gastronomy. Generations are defined by seasonings and techniques. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think receiving a family recipe is something that is of great honor. Many families protect recipes at all costs. And I think that's really fun. And I think that's very fascinating and very human, right? This idea of identity, which is ultimately this idea of culture. These are the ways that we do things. This is the way that we talk. This is the way that we love. This is the way that we hate. And through food, I explore throughout the novel as well, that smell is a human's oldest sense, right? It is back when we were in the ocean and we were bony fish and we had to smell in order to find our food. Fast forward millions of years, and here we are, still smelling and still tasting, and how that activates this reptilian brain that we have. And again, thinking about how time doesn't necessarily exist because we are feeling the same senses that we did from a fish millions of years ago. And how fun that is. That's great.
Your author's bio reads, he has lived in Washington, D.C., Brooklyn, New York, and in San Jose, Costa Rica, with his grandmother and four ghosts. Tell us about these ghosts.
So I'm Costa Rican, I'm Uruguayan. My grandmother raised me the first few years of my life, and we've had this lifelong, indestructible connection to each other. And so after I finished college in New York, I decided, hey, I'm going to write my first novel, move to Costa Rica, and get to learn everything I get to learn. What I discovered there is actually that my grandmother's house is full of ghosts. That would wake me up in the middle of the night. I would see them at the end of my bed, wake up with in a very cold sweat and room because my bed sheets were pulled off of my bed and folded on the floor. Just random little happenstances like that. And what I found out eventually was that my grandmother's father and mother, my great grandparents, her brother, my great uncle, and her husband, my grandfather, actually died on the property. And there on the property was born my father, the oldest of the siblings, and three brothers. And so I paid attention to the four deaths and the four births and realized that on that property, there is a sort of portal between worlds, right? Between death and birth. And sometimes beings can exploit that, often not for evil, but just to get on my nerves. And that was fine.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from Crocodilopolis?
My hope is to, I want to challenge the reader in the same way that I challenged myself in exploring somebody like Seth Oreamundo, in exploring people like his family, in exploring and critiquing a national mythos. I want the reader to, you know, in the same way, the reason why I love Toni Morrison so much is that she didn't meet the reader where they were. She made the reader meet them where she was at. And I really wanted to do that with this project. I wanted to say, we're going to meet hand in hand. We're going to walk throughout this book together. I'm going to challenge either your level of empathy or your gag reflex sometimes and still get to the end and still find something of meaning. Even if you hate the characters, even if you adore the characters, something that you take from it that challenges your idea of what it means to be human. And very much more specifically, I'm someone who has a sister. Many people have brothers and sisters. What it means to be a sibling, how complicated that is. Siblings are the people who we will spend the majority of our life with, not our parents, not our children, but our siblings. And what does that mean? How does it feel? And how is it hard?
Well, the book is Crocodilopolis. John Manuel Arias, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was an honor and a joy.
Crocodilopolis by John Manuel Arias was published by Bloomsbury. Joining us now is Lynn Graham, Marketing and Events Coordinator at Watermark Books and Cafe in Wichita, Kansas. Thanks for joining us again, Lynn. Always good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
So we know you have books on your stack that you want to talk about. These can be new releases, forthcoming books, or books you just can't stop thinking about. What do you want to talk about today?
I have a lot of summer releases.
Oh, fun.
This has been a good summer for, I think, just fun, kind of beachy reads, but also kind of thrillery reads, you know, get a little dark. Why not? One that I really enjoyed that I just kind of picked up as a fun, oh, I need something to listen to, is The Author Weekend by Laura Zigman. And this is about a mystery writer who is trying to match her rival and do her first author weekend and invite all her fans to come out to this little island resort for her first time. And she thinks it's just going to be this fun, like, oh, I'll feel really great about myself because I'll have all these fans around me and I'm going to invite my rival author to come. And it's going to be just such a fun time. And it devolves a little bit. It gets a little dark. I call it a descent into madness. And it was perfect. It's really quick, goes really fast. I thought the pacing was really, really well done for something like that. Didn't drag. But let me tell you, that last hour gets a little crazy. And I think it's a really good one to pick up if you just want something zippy, something really fun.
And you mentioned that you listened to it. So was it one narrator throughout? Was it a chorus of voices? How did they approach it?
Yeah, that's a great question. It actually was a chorus. So there's three or four people that are all main characters and they all have their own narrators. And I thought it was really well done.
Very good. Okay, what else do you have?
This was another one that was kind of fun. It's called The Low Job by Grace Alexander. And I describe this as British Kardashians. If you know the story of Kim Kardashian and her mother, it's kind of a play on that, but set in Britain. This woman gets involved in an affair with an MP, and she and her mother decide to turn it around for her own gain. But you learn that maybe it's also a little bit of a revenge story. And again, just a fun rich people drama kind of book that, again, I think is great if you just want a summer poolside read, beach read, goes really quick, just is really fun.
It's always fun to see how the other half lives.
Oh, yes. Speaking of, I read Rasputin Swims the Potomac by Ben Fountain. This is a satire about a potential third term for our current president. And we're in his second term. He has convinced the Senate that, yes, we should change it and president should be allowed to run. So he's embarking on his third term campaign. And there is this pro wrestler. His persona is Rasputin, and he claims he is actually Rasputin reincarnated, the Russian Rasputin. Mm-hmm. And he's very charismatic. Everyone loves him. So this president is like, oh, this is going to be my running mate. And at first, it seems like that's going to happen. And then maybe the pro wrestler decides to run his own campaign for president. And I think what I really enjoyed about this is it's very funny. It's satirical. But it made me feel a little less alone in what is happening in this administration, because I was like, okay, other people see how ridiculous things are and the just complete and utter cognitive dissonance people have around some of this. And I was like, okay, other people see this and we are writing books about it. And what's interesting is Ben Fountain wrote this in 2022. So this is pre-second term that we're in now. And he was like, well, either way this election goes is good for me, because for one, it's good for the country, and for one, it's good for the book. but he had no idea. And I thought that was really, it was a very prescient book, considering what we now know in 2026, 4 years after the book was written. And I just thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. What else has Ben Fountain written?
His other one that I think people will recognize is Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Okay. Yeah. What else do you have on your stack?
So keeping in the theme of, I've never read from these authors before, but I probably should have, I also read my first Paul Tremblay.
Oh,
and I read
horror.
Dead But Dreaming of Electric Sheep. And the interesting thing around this book is it's being marketed as sci-fi and not horror, which is what Paul Tremblay has been known for. I'm going to argue it's a sci-fi horror because I was horrified the entire time I was reading it. And mostly unsettled is how I would describe how I felt, because this book is very much a conversation about AI and where AI could go. Because this woman gets a job and she is told all she has to do is escort this man across the country. She gets there and finds out this man is brain dead and has actually had an AI system implanted in his head so that she is controlling him, basically with a video game controller, to move this brain dead man. But the twist is that we get these very bizarre, very surreal inner cut chapters from the brain of this man. So how brain dead is he?
Right.
Is it the AI talking? Is it this man talking? And like I said, I think unsettled is the only way to describe this book, because it didn't feel that far off in terms of reality or possibility. And that's the conversation this entire book is having. Our main character is very much wrestling with the ethics of what she is doing. She felt kind of coerced into it, but she's also like, do I need to help this man? Is there any way I can help him? And so I still think it is horror. It's not horror in like a gory or body horror kind of way, but in terms of real life horror and things we may have to ask ourselves soon, it very much felt like something that we are going to be coming up against.
Yeah, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, once again, you've given us an amazing stack of books to consider. Lynn Graham, Marketing and Events Coordinator at Watermark Books and Cafe in Wichita, Kansas. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Beth.
This conversation was edited for time, but you can listen to the full conversation and find a list of all of Lynn's recommendations at kmuw.org. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
The fatal shooting of a teenager at a protest in Seattle has gone unsolved for 6 years.
This is open in your face. How are there no answers?
Our investigation has uncovered new evidence and witnesses who say they've never talked to police.
Did police ever call you?
Not once.
Listen to We Keep Us Safe, a new true crime series on the Embedded podcast from NPR.